thank Roy, Dr. Aaron Siegel for agreeing to speak. It was our desire to make sure that we had specifically one shear that was going to be with Aaron Lichtenstein in mind, both in the planning as well as the Torah that was being given over. We couldn't think of someone better to do so. So thank you so much for giving, and enjoy.
Thank you very much. Thank you to all the organizers, to Libby and to Shai, to Jacob, for asking me to do this. I'm quite honored by the invitation. The shiur I was asked to give was supposed to be based on the Torah of Lichtenstein. And I hope this is based on the Torah of Lichtenstein. It's a task I approach with much trepidation. My father told me once that Rav Huttner said to a Talmud who was perhaps overly zealous in trying to bring about redemption to the world, and was quoting Rav Huttner pretty much left and right about everything that the Talmud said. And Rav Huttner said to the Talmud, I prefer that you say my Torah in your name than to say your Torah in my name. So there is obviously that risk, and I don't want to run the risk of saying my Torah in Lichtenstein's name. So I'll say at the outset that I don't know if Lichtenstein would agree with everything that's going to be said, let alone that he said everything. I certainly don't have that kind of memory or recall. But on the other hand, I obviously don't want to run the risk of saying his Torah in my name. So what I'll say is that everything that's right, that sounds right, it's almost certainly something that he said, and everything else is what I said. The Gemara in Bava Basra and Daf Kuf brings a machlokes hatanaim, Rabbi Eliezer and the Chachamim. The Braisa says, halach ba l'orka or l'rachba, kana makom hilucho. If a person takes a walk around a field, a plot of land, its width and its length, then he acquires that place that he walked. Dibur Rabbi Eliezer. The Chachamim omrim ein hiluch moil klum ad shiachzik. Chachamim say hiluch doesn't work at all until he does a chazaka. Apparently, according to Chachamim, this itself doesn't count as a chazaka. Amar Rabbi Eliezer, my time with Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Eliezer, the Amora said, what is Rabbi Eliezer's rationale? What is his source? Dichsiv kum hitalech v'aretz l'orka ulrachba kilcha etnena. He brings the pasuk, Bereishis Yud Gimel, where Kadosh Baruch Hu says to Avram that you should go take a trek throughout the aretz, throughout the land, l'orka l'rachba, because I'm going to give it to you. And Rabbi Eliezer understands that to mean that by doing that, he's giving it to him, he's acquiring it. V'rabanan, the Rabbanan respond, Hasa mishum chavivusa d'Avram hu dika amarlei. That was only because of how beloved Avram was to him that he told him that. In order that it should be easy, it should be simple, it should be straightforward for his children to conquer it. And Rabbi, the Chachamim's response is puzzling. What exactly is meant by this? What is meant that this is supposed to make things easier? Is anyone going to let them in just to take over the country because Avram Avinu walked the Arka al-Rachba? So the Ritva on this Gemara brings several interpretations, several understandings of what's going on here. Apparently he didn't have the Girsa, or at least some of his texts didn't have the Girsa that has the second half, and all he had was Mishum Chavivusa d'Avram hudgamarlei. And so his first explanation is that he's just trying to inform Avram, because of how much he loved Avram, that this was going to be the matana that his descendants were going to get. But then he says, well, there's this medrash, and as we have a gears in the Gemara, it's just actually in our Gemara, that says that it's so that it should be Noach Lichbosh, which doesn't fit with the first interpretation that he offered. So he offers a second interpretation. Perhaps it's more than just one more interpretation. I'll read it. Shelo yafsidu hazarob avanotehem v'shelo yuchal satan l'katreg. Inami shiavo b'ta'ana uve'edei avot al shiva amimin v'shelo yiyeh nireh kegezel. One could read this as perhaps up to four explanations. He did this so that his children, his descendants, would not lose this in their sins, that the Satan would not be able to prosecute and say, this is not yours, or, relatedly, that they'll be able to come with a claim, with testimony about their avot. When the Shiva Amamin, when those who currently inhabit Eretz Canaan, when they get there, say, this is Gezel. I'm not sure the Ritva's explanation fully explains what's going on here. After all, if it's in fact the case that there was no Kinyan, if it's in fact the case that Avram wasn't Koneh, the land at that time, the Hilucho, the Arka, the Rachba, then isn't the Taina of the Shiva Amin correct? What good does it do to bring the Taina that our Avos walked here, that Avram Avinu walked the Arka of the Rachba? And how does Avram Avinu's walking the Arka of the Rachba prevent Klal Yisrael from losing Eretz Yisrael if they chas v'shalom commit any sins? So the truth of the matter is that with regard to the question of how this indeed prevents a counterclaim or a claim of Gezel, the Ritva says that as a matter of fact, Avram Avinu was Koneh, that the land halachically became Avram's, all of Eretz Canaan. And the Ritva has two explanations of how this came to be. After all, according to the Chachamim, it didn't come to be through Hiluch, through walking. He says maybe, just like Amir LeGavoa, if you make a commitment to Gavoa, then it has the status of a Kinyan, so too, in reverse, if there's an Amiras Gavoa, if God makes a commitment, then that is automatically Machne something. Or he says, Bechezkas Yeshiva. That there was a Chezkas Kinyan, it wasn't the walking Archa or the Rachba. It was the fact that Avram took hold of at least part of Eretz Yisrael, and in taking hold of, in being machzik on part of Eretz Yisrael, in just where he lived and how he lived, he could take possession of all of Eretz Yisrael. The truth is, there is what to say for the position that indeed Avram took possession in some way or another of Eretz Yisrael, that Klal Yisrael, when they came into Eretz Yisrael, or the Yotzei Mitzrayim, when they left Mitzrayim, didn't have to do anything to take possession. It was already theirs. It was already a Yerusha Me'avoseihem. That seems to be what emerges from the Gemara in Bava Basra and Daf Kuf Yud Tes. The Gemara there is discussing the topic of Ein HaBechor Notel Baro'oi Kivamuchzak. The Bechor gets Pishnayim in everything that his father had, but only that which his father was muchzak on at the time of the father's death, not that which is roy, that which is going to come along to the father, but not muchzak at the time that he died. And the Gemara says, it's a slightly complicated discussion as to why the Gemara has to say this. Essentially, the point is that the Mishnah assumes that Slavchad inherited the portion of Chefer, Chefer was one of the Yotzei Mitzrayim, his father, as a Bechor, and so is Notel Pishnayim, even though it doesn't seem like Chefer ever took possession of Eretz Yisrael, of Eretz Canaan. And so the Gemara says, Rabba says, no, it must be Eretz Yisrael Mukzekes he. As the Rashbam explains, it means that he had it as a Yerusha, presumably from his ancestors all the way back to Avram Avinu. But matters aren't so simple. For one thing, Rabba is not the only opinion in that Gemara. Rabbi Yehuda Amar Shmuel has a different explanation of how it is that Tzlachad was Yoresh Pishnayim. Secondly, when I was preparing for this year, I was thinking this sugya has to be relevant, so I have to figure out what's the definition of Roy and Muchsak, and that I need Rav Lichtenstein to help. I couldn't find my notes on Bava Basra. I opened up the Gemara Bava Basra, and there were just three pages in the Gemara, and it was on the sugya of Roy Kiva Muchsak. I was quite appreciative for that, that I had been so sloppy and left some pages in my Gemara. And I looked, and Rav Lichtenstein indeed discusses the definition. What does it mean to be Muchsak in this context? For the purposes of Ein HaBachor No Tel Baroi Kiva Muchsak, what do you have to have? What standard do you have to meet to be Muchsak for these purposes? And he raised the possibility that it's not ownership. Bailus, actual legal ownership, is not required. He brought several possible rayas to this effect. I'll just mention the Gemara and Daf Kuf Chav Gimel in Bava Basra talks about Makirei Kahuna, those who know a certain Kohen very well, and it's expected they're going to be giving their matnos kahuna to that Kohen, the Zro, the Chayayim, and the Keva. And the Gemara says that if you have a case of Makirei Kahuna, then even before the matnos kahuna are given, those things have a status of muchzak. That is, the Kohen himself is considered a muchzak on those things. And there is a machlokas Rishonim and Achronim, as to whether the Kohen already has bailus, whether he already owns the matnos kahuna. If you look at Tosfos Alatar, Kuf Chaf Gimel, it sounds like, at least in parts of Tosfos, that Tosfos thinks that he's not the bailum, he doesn't really own it. Right, so according to Tosfos, at the very least, and other shitos that he quoted, the fact that you're muchzak on something, the fact that they were muchzak, the Kohen is muchzak on these matnos kahuna, doesn't imply necessarily that you own it. And so you could say the same thing about Eretz Yisrael. Perhaps we were muchzak, as Rabba says, muchzak in Eretz Yisrael, muchzekasi, and yet we didn't really own it until we got there. And indeed, this seems to be the straightforward understanding of the Gemara in Kiddushin. It's almost inescapable. The Gemara in Kiddushin, on the Mishnah that says that there is such a thing as Kinyan Chazaka, that you can be Kona Karka with Chazaka, it asks, Minalan, how do we know this? Amra Chizkiya, this is on Daf Chavav, Amra Kra, Pasuk in Yirmiyo, Ushvu Ba'arechem Asher Tafastem, Bameh Tafastem B'yeshiva, right, stay in your cities that you took hold of. With what did you take hold of them? The Gemara says, B'yeshiva. Reading the Pasuk as Ushvu, that is the manner in which you took hold of them. Deber bishmal tana, v'yirishtem osa, v'yishavtem ba, the pasuk in Bar Mit Aleph, b'me yarashtem, b'yeshiva. Both of these psukim are talking about the Yerusha of Am Yisrael when they got into Eretz Yisrael. The Yishuv Haaretz, that took place later in history. And so it seems that they performed a Maisa Kinyan. It seems that they performed a Chazaka, and one that was effective. Right? If it wasn't effective, if they didn't actually do anything that was halachically characterized as a Maisa Kinyan, as a Chazaka, it's hard to see how we could learn that Chazaka works from what they did. But of course, if they already owned Eretz Yisrael, they already owned Eretz Canaan before they got there, then why would they need a Chazaka? What role would it play? You can't perform a Maisa Kinyan on something you already own. So it's difficult. It's difficult to assume, as the Ritva does, that Avram Avinu really was Kona Eretz Canaan, to be Morish to his children, and so there isn't really any problem with Gezel anyway. It's difficult to assume that. So how are we to understand the Gemara? So I wanted to take a step back, as Rav Lichtenstein did in this context, to look at the nature of cheskas kinyan. What is a chazaka that allows you to be kone karka? So the Gemara in Bava Basra, Mishnah, in Bava Basra on Daf Mem Beis, Aleph, says Hamachzik Benitse Hager Naal got the Gadar Uparatz Kolshehu Harezo Chazaka. As the Gemara here explains, we'll tend up later. We mean if you're trying to be Kone something, that it's trying to be Kone Karko, not talking anymore about Cheskas Raya, which is the subject of the first half of Perek Cheskas Abatim. Now we move into Cheskas Kinyan. If you want to do that, you got to do one of these three things. Nal, v'gadar, uparatz, kol shehu. What is the definition of these things? In particular, what does it mean, nal? So here there's a machlokes harishonim. The Rashbam, on Daf Nun Gimel, says that it means you install the lock. There's a structure, a house, that didn't have a lock on it before, you install the lock and thereby take possession of the house. He says, on the other hand, if you just lock the door, which may be the simple explanation, the simple reading of na'al means that you locked it, he says, that's not a chazaka. That doesn't count. Even though you've now precluded others from entering, that's not a ma'isa kinyan. It doesn't count as a kinyan chazak. Tosvos, Alatar, and others say no. They bring rayas from other gemaras, particularly gemara in Gittin and Dafayin Zion, which seems to say that yes, you can be kone just by closing the door and locking the door. And Tosvos, they disagree with the Rashbam, and they give a rationale. Tosva speaks in terms of raya, in terms of evidence, that if you lock the door, it's evident that it's yours. You are acting, you're behaving like an owner, like a bailiff. You know, usually, unless you're doing someone else a favor, go ahead and lock the door of a certain house. Unless it's yours, you're excluding others from entry, you're behaving like an owner. We're not talking about a cheskas raya here, we're talking about a cheskas kinyan, and yet Tosfos says this is sufficient for being kone the house. So Rav Lichtenstein suggested one suggestion as to how to understand this machlokas between the Rashbam and Tosfos, is that it's a machlokas about how to understand the nature of cheskas kinyan, understand the nature of this particular type of kinyan on karka. That Tosvos holds, as we just said, right, that it's a matter of demonstrating bailus, haftanat ba'alut, that you are acting like only an owner would act, and that all by itself gives you possession of the karka, gives you possession of the building. Whereas the Rashbam holds that it's a matter of molding, shaping, building. If you affect a change for the better, to make an improvement in something, and that gives you a certain right to it. You take possession of it because you've done something for it. And there are other nafkaminas that he suggests for this question. If you just look in Rabbeinu Yonah on Nun Gimel, in Bavatra Nun Gimel, he says what Tosfos says in terms of understanding the nature of Cheskas Kinyan. And then he goes on to list other consequences of this. So you could take what he's saying as just a list of nafkaminas between these two ways of looking at Cheskas Kinyan. One nafkamina is the Gemara earlier on Daf Chavtes, the Gemara in Bava Basra on Chavtes, talks about how you're supposed to be kona something, a piece of karka that's just too rocky to do anything with, right? To plow, to plant. There's nothing really you can make of it. And the Gemara says, Ukmi bach yusei, in the case of what the Gemara calls sunma. One way that this will work is if you put your animals there, right? You let your animals take rest in this place, you park them there, then that will work. The Rambam holds that we're talking about Cheskas Kinyan and Akimara. The Ravid argues, the Ravid in Hilchos Mechira and in Perak Aleph, Halacha Yud Gimel or Yud Dalid, says, no, you're not Kona in that case. The Gemara wasn't talking about Cheskas Kinyan there, you misunderstood. The Gemara was just talking about Cheskas Raya, the notion that you can prove that you're really the owner by having used it for a certain amount of time in a certain kind of way, but this won't actually affect a change in ownership. This is not a Cheskas Kinyan. This is a case in which you make use of the land, but you don't do anything for it. You don't make any improvements. And so this too can be a nafka mina. According to the Rambam, perhaps it's a matter of demonstrating that you're the bailim. Bailim are the kinds of people, owners, the ones who make use of things like this. Whereas according to the Ravid, it's a matter of improving the situation, of building, of molding, and that you don't have here. It's another case very much like this, which for Lichtenstein, Zatzal mentioned. A different kind of nafkamina consequence of this question is the discussion, Machlokas Amoraim on Daf Nun Dalet, about Asade HaMesuyemes B'Mei Tzareha. You have a field that is demarcated clearly in its borders. And then all you do is you do a little bit of work on just a small portion of the land. The question is, can you be Kona the entire field with just what you did on that small portion of land, small portion of the field? Shmuel says, no, you only are Kona that place that you actually worked. Whereas Rav says, no, you're Kona the whole thing, Kona the entire field. And here, too, we can understand that this is a machlokes about how to understand the nature of Cheskas Kinyan. According to Rav, it's a matter of demonstrating bailus. Well, if you weren't the bailim on the whole field, you wouldn't be working any of the field, right? I mean, it's not your right to just go into someone else's field and start mixing around, mixing in, doing anything. So you're effectively demonstrating bailus on the entire field, and so you're kona the whole thing. Whereas, according to Shmuel, you get the right to it in virtue of what you do, of what you improve, of what you build. But matters aren't so simple. Things get more complicated. As Rav Lichtenstein Zatzal noted, says, for example, the Rashbam seems to agree in certain cases that usage will work, that usage will be effective. Rashbam, at least in some places, distinguishes between nichsei hefker and a case of das acheres makne. Nichasim, things that don't belong to anyone at all, that's nichsei hefker, what the Gemara sometimes calls nichsei hager, because we're talking about a ger who died without any yorshim. And on the other hand, a das acheres makne, a case in which someone is selling you this piece of land or this building or is giving it to you, there's some other party involved. Rashbam, at least in some places, says in the case of das acheres makne, even just benefiting from the land can work. That can affect a kinyan. While the Rashbam is somewhat ambiguous on this, the Rambam seems unambiguous. He is the leader of this camp and its most radical proponent. The camp who says that there is a distinction to be drawn between nichsei hefker and a case of das acheres makne. And here, you don't have to look very far to find his makor. The Gemara on Daf Nun Zayin, and Cheskas Batim yet again, brings a statement of Ula, Omer Ula kol she'ilu b'nichsei hager kana b'nichsei chaveru kana. So Ula seems to take the position that there's no distinction to be drawn between Nitzei Hager and Nitzei Chavero. Whatever works for one works for the other. Maskif la Rav Sheshes. Rav Sheshes asks, Uklalahu, is that really an unexceptionable principle? V'harei nir, de b'nichsei hager kana, b'nichsei chavero lo kana. V'harei achilas peros, de b'nichsei chavero kana, b'nichsei hager lo kana. There are exceptions in both directions. You plow a field, he says, that then it's b'nichsei hager, you're kona, but b'nichsei chavero, you're not kona. Conversely, if you eat fruits, produce of the field, then b'nichsei chavero kana, that works in the case of nichsei chavero, but not b'nichsei hager. Now what does this Gemara mean? So the Rashbam here says that nichsei chavero and nichsei hager are just code words. We don't really mean that. The distinction is really between who owns this or whether it has any owner at all. Nichsei hager is being used to refer to a case of Cheskas Kinyon, and Achila and Nichsei Chavero is being used as a code word for Cheskas Raya. And all the Gemara means to say is that plowing will work as a Cheskas Kinyon, you can be kona a field by plowing the whole thing, but not as a Cheskas Raya, whereas Achilas Peros, it's the opposite. If you eat the fruits of the field for 3 years, right, then that serves as a cheskas raya, but not as a cheskas kinyan. But the Rambam did not interpret the Gemara this way. Okay, the Rambam, in Hilchos Mechira, tells us what chazaka is. That's where he lays down the first time what a cheskas kinyan is. He mentions that achilas peros works. I mean, that's where he mentions, like we said before, that if you lay out your fruits, that too works, right? Even if you haven't worked the land at all, but you're getting benefit from it. And that's where the Ravid disagrees. So in Mecher, that's what he says. And then in Zechio Matana, he says, everything I said before is true. Everything I said in Hilchos Mechira is true here as well, if we're talking about Nichsei Hager, except for the fact that Achilas Peros is kona b'mechira or b'matana, but it's not kona b'nichsei hager. But then he also goes on to say that there are all these things that you can do, minor fixings, right, that you can make in a land, a piece of land, or in a structure, which will allow you to acquire those things in the case of nichsei hager, and those are not things that he mentions in Hilchos Mechira. It seems as though he takes this Gemara, what Rav Sheshes says, to mean what it means in Pshat, and so he's mechalek, he distinguishes in both directions, between Nichsei Hager and a case of Das Acheres Makneh, that in the case of Das Acheres Makneh, there Achilas Peros works, but not Nir, but not Harisha, and conversely in a case where you're being koneme hefker. If you're being koneme hefker, then you can do so through harisha, right, through plowing, but you can't do so through achilas peros. And the question is, what's the explanation? It doesn't seem to be just here with respect to this distinction that we find it. The question is only heightened by the fact that even with regard to Shmuel, what we said before, there's machlokas, Rav and Shmuel, about whether you're kone kol hasadeh, or you're just kone that part that you worked. Many of the Rishonim are bothered by Shmuel's position. They're bothered because it seems inconsistent with another position of Shmuel, the position of Shmuel in Kiddushin, that you can be kone eser sados, 10 fields that are not even adjacent to one another, just by performing a chazaka on one part of one field. So how are you to reconcile that? In one place he says you can't even call it one whole field just by doing a chazak on one part. So several Rishonim say, the Rambam seems to assume this, the Rimi Gash articulates this explicitly, there's a difference between being kone mehefker and being kone with a das aferes makneh. that when Shmuel said, if you work just a small part of the field, you're not kona the entire thing, he was talking about a case in which the field was hefker. In that case, you only get what you work. Whereas, in the case of Das Acheres Makne, there he agrees, there, if you work just one part of one field, you can be kona all the fields that the Das Acheres wants to be makne to you. And so you seem to have the same point, the same distinction, essentially, as the one that we find in the Rambam. But the question is why? What underlies this distinction? So here, you could say several things. On the one hand, you might say that there is a fundamental difference between the kinyan that one performs in a case of Das Acheres Makne and the nature of the kinyan, that is what is expected of you in a case of Nitzei Hager. The standards are different in the two cases. And the standards are different because the nature of Cheska's kinyan is different in the two cases. And if there's Das Acheres Makne, then the way it works is that the Das Acheres, the other party to the kinyan, is recognizing you as the owner. Recognizing what you're doing and who you are as ownership and as an owner. Whereas in the case of Hefker, the way that you're kone is that you do something that gives you a right. You can take hold of something. You gain a right to something by improving it, by doing something like Uman Kona B'Shvach Kelov, according to one position. Right? If you improve something, if you shape it, if you mold it, then that gives you a right. Right. But the right is only something that you can attain if you're going into an empty field, metaphorically speaking. If there's someone else there who already has a claim to it, then you can't lay claim to it by bettering it. So that's not going to work in Das Acheres Makne. It's only going to work in a case of Nitzei Hager. And conversely, in the case of Nitzei Hager, you can't have the other party recognizing you as the Baalim because there is no other party. So Hafganat Baalut, demonstration of one's ownership, won't work in Nitzei Hager. It will work in Das Acheres Makne. And improving the field will work in Nitzei Hager, but won't work in Das Acheres Makne. Similarly, when it comes to trying to be kone one whole field, or even 10 distinct fields, if you only work on a small part, Hafganat Baalut is the nature of Cheskas Kinyan and Das Acheres Makne. So if you take hold of one little part, then you can take hold of the whole thing, like we said in the Shita of Rav. Even Shmuel will agree to that in the case of Das Acheres Makne. Whereas in the case of Nitzei Hager, there the nature of the Cheskas Kinyan is different. The nature of the Cheskas Kinyan is that you improve it and you only get what you improve. That's one way to understand the distinction, that there's a difference in standard. There's another way, which I imagine Rav Lichtenstein would say is less yisodi, less fundamental, but it is, I think, important for us to understand the Gemara that we started with. The second explanation is to say that no, there's one kind of Cheskas Kinyan here. It's just showing, demonstrating, acting like you are the owner. It's the same standard throughout. There's just a difference in the cases in terms of what you have, in terms of what's brought to the table. And the difference in terms of what's brought to the table comes about because of the context. Whether there's a Das Acheres Makne there or not, whether this is just Nitzei Hefker or not, that context to the act that you're performing will determine the nature of the act that you're performing. It will determine whether or not what you're doing really is an act of Hafganat Baalut. Rav Lichtenstein very much liked to quote the Shita of the Ravid in the Sugya of Oder B'Nichsei Hager. This is one of those things. I never heard of the sugya of Oder Nitzah Hagera before he first brought it up, but then he brings it up, and he makes it sound like, I don't know, this is the first daf in Brachos. Like, how do you not know Oder Benitzah Hagera? So from then on, I just assumed this is, you know, fundamental sugya and shas. And that's how it stuck in my memory. Otherwise, probably wouldn't. The sugya in Yevamos on Nunbeis that Oder Benitzah Hagera v'kasavur shehein shelo. If you're working on a Nitzah Hager, right, as Rashi explains, a fence, let's say, between your field and the adjacent field falls down, and it's then rebuilt. That's a case in Cheska Sabatim. Case in Yevamos is you're working your field, and you work someone else's field with it. But you think that's your field, right? It's not clear to you the boundary between your field and someone else's field. So you end up working that other person's field, thinking that it's yours. But now, it's not exactly someone else's field, it's a nitzei hager, right? Oder b'nitzei hager, by which we mean not a ger, chas v'shalom, of course, that would be his field. We mean it belonged to a ger, and then he passed away, like I said before, without any yorshim, so it's now hefger. And the Gemara in Yevamos says, you're not Kone. Oder b'nitzei hager, b'kasavur shein shelo, is not Kone. You didn't have Kavana. And Reb Lichtenstein explained along the lines of the Rav and Reb Chaim in many other contexts in Shas, that the lack of Kavana here is not just the lack of Das, to use the terminology that he would use. It's not just that you didn't have the appropriate further intention to be Kone, the field. The problem is that because, as far as you were concerned, you were still working your own field, the Maisa itself, the act that you were doing itself, can't even qualify as a Maisa Kinyan. The Kavana, the lack of Kavana in this case, undermines the status of the act that you're doing as an act that can be called a Maisa Kinyan. But, Lichtenstein said, in Muke Yosef, in Basra, Chaf Beis Amud Aleph Bedape Arif, he's talking about the other Gemara I was referring to before, about a fence that falls down. The Ravid says this works. Oder benichsei chaveiro v'kasavur shehein shelo works. That is a cheskas kinyan, of course, on the assumption that chaveiro wants to give this to you. You don't just automatically take possession of it because you start working his field. Right? If you have das acheres maknef, the other side wants this to be yours, then even if, as far as you're concerned, you're just working your own field, you're still kone. So Lichtenstein said, you see here a position, which is contrary to what he said, the shach holds in certain areas, that das acheres maknef can actually resurrect, rehabilitate a maisa kinyan that wasn't a Maisa Kinyan because it was lacking in some way, and turn it into one. The presence of someone else, the presence of another party, can turn it into a Maisa Kinyan. I think the Ravid is Lashitaso, perhaps here. The Ravid in the Shita Mekubetzes, in Bava Basra, in Daphne and Gimel, he says, Vani tamea me'ayin hotziu ze'a hefresh, ben nichse hager l'shar hanechasim. Where did they get this distinction? Where did Rav Sheshes get it? Where did the Rambam get it? I'm not quite sure how to make sense of the fact that the Ravid argues with the Rambam in the Mishnah Torah, but then he answers the question here. At any rate, here's what he says. V'yesh lomar, ki b'nichse ha-ger em hefker, v'hayotze mehem hefker. V'im zacha b'yotze bahem, lo zacha bahem. In case of nichse ha-ger, the nechasim are hefker, so the fruit that grows out of them are hefker. So there's the nechasim, the land itself, there's the fruit, it's all hefker. So if you take the fruit, you eat the fruit, you're not zocha in the land by doing that. You're zocha in the fruits, which are hefker. Aval kishetikein bahem tikun moil bar zocha begufan. But when you do something that affects a positive change, then you're in the land itself. Then you're zocha begufan. Then you take possession of it itself. V'amachzik b'nichsei chaveiro. But if you're being machzik b'nichsei chaveiro, it's precisely the opposite. Ki bal hanechasim makpid al hayotzei mehem. Im yochal oto acher, right? Obviously, someone who owns a field, unless he's extremely charitable, He has a hakpada that other people shouldn't come and take all of his food, all of his fruits, all the things that grow there. And so if you do that, if you eat from his fruits, despite the fact that normally a person has a hakpada that someone else won't eat from his fruits, that shows that you're acting like the owner and being recognized as such. Right? But he's not makpid, in general, on someone coming in and improving his property. That's only for the good. What does the Ravid mean? I think what he means is this. That whether you're demonstrating that you are the bailim, whether you're acting like the owner, will depend on the circumstance. And so something that would otherwise not be a demonstration of ownership, something that would otherwise not be a maisa kinyan at all, can turn into a maisa kinyan because of a change in context. In one direction, it'll turn into a maisa kinyan because there's someone present, because there's a das acheres makne. That's the case where you're eating fruits from his field. And in another case, in the opposite direction, it will be hafganat balut on the karka itself. It will demonstrate that you possess the land itself when you plow it or improve it in some way or other. That's if there's no one there at all, if there's no one on the other side. With this understanding that whether you have a demonstration of ownership, whether you have a maisa kinyan will depend on the context in which it occurs, I think we can go back to our original question and suggest an answer. The purpose of Avraham's walking, la'arka u'l'rachba, was to inform the nature of the act that was to be done by Klal Yisrael later on. After all, as the Rashbam in Baba Basra notes, the Netziv notes on the pasuk of Kum Hitalech Baretz la'arka u'l'rachba, when Bnei Yisrael came into the land the first time with Yehoshua, they didn't need to do anything. They didn't need to build at all. There was batim le'im koltuv. Everything was there for them. All they had to do was live, was sit there. No binyan was necessary. No improvement was necessary. It was Noach. They could just go and take possession. But that could only be done, that would only affect a transfer, affect a kinyan, because of what Avraham Avinu had done before. He turned Klal Yisrael into Bnei Eretz Yisrael even before they got there. Rav Lichtenstein Zatzal quoted in his sicha he gave about this pasuk of Kum Hitalech Baretz and the Gemara and Daf Kuf and Baba Basra. At the time, I didn't realize it was an inversion because I didn't know Robert Frost. Robert Frost said the land was ours before we were the lands, referring to America. And Lichtenstein said we were the lands before the land was ours. And that was because of what Avraham Avinu did. It was because of the charge that God gave to Avraham Avinu, and because Avraham took upon himself that charge. He walked the full breadth, length of Eretz Yisrael. And like Rav Lichtenstein said in another sicha about Yaakov Avinu, and what Yaakov Avinu did, why it says, Vayeshev Yaakov be'eretz begurei aviv, that he lived in the land of his forefathers. He said that by doing this, by Avram doing what he did, and by Yaakov doing what he did, they guaranteed that any departure would be merely temporary, would be merely physical, but that the identity of Klal Yisrael, where they were in their heart and their soul, would always be in Eretz Yisrael, and would always be the place that they were heading back to. And so when Klal Yisrael arrived in Eretz Yisrael, it was Noach Lehem. All they had to do was inhabit the houses. That wouldn't have been good enough. It wouldn't have been a demonstration of bailus, a demonstration of ownership. if it wasn't clear who they were, if it wasn't clear that they were the descendants of Avram Avinu, who had said, this is my place, this is my home, and this will be the home of my descendants. Rav Lichtenstein when he got to Eretz Yisrael, he didn't just inhabit places. He built. He was a master builder and he was a master architect. He built so many things. He built sugyas, brick by brick, until there was this incredible structure and edifice. He had built it already, but then he also showed us how to build it. Shir Yomi was an absolutely exhilarating experience because, well, there was also the fear, of course, but he took you by your hand and he showed you how to build a sugya. It was just absolutely breathtaking. By the end, you felt like you had constructed the edifice. Of course, that was not true. I mean, he was building the edifice. He had already built the edifice, and he was just showing you how to recreate it. He had all of the sugyas built before his mind. There wasn't a sugya, as far as we could tell, that he didn't already have mapped out. It's not just that he knew all the sugyas. It's not just that he could tell you what was on every daf and every mesefta. He had an entire map of the entire landscape. And it had to have been to someone who could actually behold it, which only he could. I certainly didn't have that privilege. I only got fragments as he presented them. To behold such a structure must have been quite a sight. He built a family, as we heard from his family, those of you who watched the Hespedim, those of you who heard what he said his proudest achievement was. It's truly something to emulate, see that as someone's proudest achievement. He, together with his wife, of course, built an incredible family. He, together with Amital, built the yeshiva. From basically nothing, he built an extended community of followers, and he built each and every one of us who were lucky enough to have been his talmidim. He didn't build us from the ground up, of course, but he shaped us in ways that were radically transformative. But throughout all this building, and all of it so original, so creative, so impressive, it was 100% clear. I had absolutely no doubt that he didn't build these things in order to build a magnificent edifice or to leave a lasting legacy. He did this because the Torah demanded it of him, because Am Yisrael demanded it of him, and most of all because the Ribono Shel Olam demanded it of him. These demands, these commanding voices that you could just see and hear in everything that he did, for him they called out from throughout Jewish history. They captured every fiber of his being. We can say he was the land's before the land was his. He belonged to Am Yisrael long before his contributions to Am Yisrael made all of us his possession. He was the Torah's before it became Uvsoraso Yegeh, Yomam Valayla. And of course he was the consummate Eved Hashem long before he completed his avodah and left this world. I realize time is short, but if you'll permit me just to say a few more words, personal reflections on Rav Lichtenstein Zatzal. You can feel free to leave. I understand people have shir now. If you have shir, of course, feel free to leave. Despite the fact that I've had 3 days to think about this, I've still not been able to collect myself, not been able to collect my thoughts. So I apologize that these will be somewhat haphazard, maybe not as coherent as I would like, and that the Lichtenstein Zatzal, of course, deserved. I'll start by saying it wasn't a foregone conclusion that I would merit to learn under Rav Lichtenstein and to be in his presence. I went to a high school where those who were thought to excel were pushed to go to the Mir, maybe to the Toras Moshe. Despite the fact that several of my brothers had gone to Yeshivat Har Etzion, that's where I planned to go. A member of the staff at my high school, many, many others, said, "I want to talk to you, I want to discuss with you your plans for next year." So I spoke to him, I admired him very much, I still admire him very much. He said to me, "I understand you want to go and learn Yeshivat Har Etzion." I said, "Yeah, that's my plan right now." And he said, "Can you tell me why?" And I stammered. I did not have a good answer. Perhaps I was going there because my brothers went there. Perhaps I was going there because that's where I was expected to go. I said something to the effect that I had read some of his articles and found them very impressive. It's not a very impressive answer as to why one would go to study there, but that's what I said. And he said to me, "You know, I know he is an impressive intellect. I guess that's undeniable, no one can deny that. But he is a very big Talmud Chacham. But look, I mean, I've read some of his stuff. It's so cool, so calculated, so measured. There's no fire there. There's no passion." I didn't know what to say. I'd never met Lichtenstein. So I went home, told my parents, "You know, I want to reconsider my decision. Maybe I don't want to go to Yeshivat Har Etzion." My father, who was a man of few words, had always told me, "Lichtenstein is an Adam Gadol. There's no question he's an Adam Gadol." But he never said much more. He's a man of few words. So he told my brother, this is what I gathered, he didn't tell me this, but he told my brother should tell me why I should go to Yeshivat Har Etzion, to get me to go there. So my brother took me outside and said, "Aaron, you really have to go to Yeshivat Har Etzion." "Okay, thank you. Why?" He too was a man of few words. And he said, "Because Rav Lichtenstein is an Adam Gadol. He is a giant." At that point, I didn't really know what to do, but I trusted my brother. I trusted my father. I said, "If they think this is what's best, this is what I should do." So I went to Yeshivat Har Etzion. I began to understand what my Rebbe from high school had said, not because he was right, just to make that clear at the outset, but I understood what he said. And I also understood it was so difficult for them to communicate to me, my brother and my father, how he was an Adam Gadol. People have said, in a speaking that I've heard, that Lichtenstein was a Ner Tamid. He was a light that was always there, never extinguished. In my experience, when I first encountered him, he was not a Ner Tamid. He was an Eish Tamid Tukad Ala Mizbeach Lo Sichbeh. Rav Lichtenstein once gave a sicha about that pasuk, the beginning of Tzav. He said, Why do you need both? Ish tamid tu kalal mizbeach. It has to always be there. And lo sichbeh. Isn't this redundant? So you heard the Ramban, who said that there are two issues here. The Ramban based on the Torah's Kohanim. Ish tamid tu kalal mizbeach. Means you have to always ensure there's an ish there. And lo sichbeh, don't diminish it at all. If you diminish it, if you take away one gachelet, you're over here on a lav. But Lichtenstein said, this is a message for us, that our passion, our fire, has to be constant and never diminish in its intensity. I wouldn't know what that means. I tell you, I would not know what he meant by that if not for seeing him live it. His passion, his deep, deep passion, was continuous and as intense as I could possibly imagine. There were times when it was more obvious. People have mentioned that on Yom Kippur, he would stay up all night and give a shiur on Avodas Yom HaKippurim. It was Talmud Torah. He was giving a shiur all night. But the fire that you saw, it lit up his face. I have never seen another person with a countenance like that. What he looked like then is what I hope the Kohen Gadol looks like when he does the Avodah. Ever since I left Gush, every Yom Kippur, I tell my wife, Yom Kippur night, I am bereft. I can't go to the shir. Just to see Rav Lichtenstein, this undiminished, an unbridled passion for the Torah, the Avodos Yom HaKippurim, and for the Ribono Shel Olam. It wasn't just the spiritual highs that brought out the passion, it was the spiritual lows. On Tisha B'Av, I told this to a few students in my class, there weren't so many people left in yeshiva on Tisha B'Av, so you could sit near a Lichtenstein if you wanted. So one Tisha B'Av that I was there, I sat pretty close to Rav Lichtenstein. Since we're all on the floor, it's all this stuff that's obstructing our view, so he couldn't know that anyone could see him. And maybe I shouldn't have looked, so private. But when I looked and I saw his crying, I knew what it meant to cry. Not just over the base HaMikdash, but anything. But certainly over the base HaMikdash. I had never seen anyone cry like that over the base HaMikdash. It was incredible. And then to see his passion every day, between the highs and the lows, his passion for Torah, his passion for Tefillah, is truly remarkable. But I didn't blame at that point my high school Rebbe, as I said before, because it's really no wonder that he had made a mistake. If you had only heard of Rav Lichtenstein's towering intellect, maybe you had dabbled in Rav Lichtenstein's writings, noticing that every formulation was careful and measured, every issue complex, you just would not have thought it possible that he could also have been an Eish Tamid. And as I went on in yeshiva, the appearance of impossibility, of that there just couldn't be someone like this, only deepened. But he was evidently an Eish Tamid, but it became clear that his was a fire that never burnt anyone, never singed anyone, never hurt anyone at all. He was a fire that only warmed. There were no rough edges. I mean, of course we were all awed by him. We trembled before asking him any questions. He was a gavra de mishtefinamine, as many have said. But a lowly Talmud like me could have a personal relationship with him. I never once walked away from an interaction being made to feel like I had intruded, or that it was beneath him to address my misunderstandings, my confusions. Never, not once. Of course, this is due in part to his deep sensitivity and completely unassuming manner and humility, about which many people have spoken. They're the stuff of legend. I'll say just a few things about his sensitivity, his humility. People have mentioned how he looked in Motzei Yom Kippur, like a Malach Hashem Tzvakos. Shortly after Yom Kippur, we would daven Mariv. I was in Avelos one year for my mother, Aleha Shalom. And so I would be davening for the Amud. I got to see an incredible thing. For Mariv of Yom Kippur, Motzei Yom Kippur, when Rav Lichtenstein was no doubt at spiritual levels that I could only imagine, when I got to the end of saying Kriyat Shema myself, he waved me on. He didn't make a big deal. He just went like this. Only I could see. Only I knew. He wasn't done with Kriyat Shema yet. We always waited for him for Kriyat Shema, and he was going to take much longer to say his Kriyat Shema. But he waved me on. He waved me on at the end of his Shmoneh Esrei. While he was saying Shmoneh Esrei, at the end of our Shmoneh Esrei, he waved me on because although he was at that point the Malach Hashem Tzvakos, simply belonging to another world, the concern for the mundane needs of his Talmidim, who he knew were very hungry and were not going to be able to daven Amarev the way he was, it made it all the more remarkable. He was demanding, completely and utterly demanding, but also extraordinarily understanding of us and our shortcomings, and that his demands were, of course, quite high. When I was in Avelos, without fail, whenever I would speak to him, whenever I would ask him a question, before I had a chance to open my mouth, he would say, "How's your father doing?" It's because he cared about my father, but he was also teaching me a lesson to be the Chavirav, that I should be asking, "How's my father doing?" That year when I was davening for the Amud, apparently I took a little too long. I think I went about 3 or 4 minutes over the average time for Shacharis that was ordinary, they were used to in Gush, we were used to. It's not as though I wanted to do that, that's just how it seemed to happen. And I got wind of the fact that some people were not coming to Shacharis in Yeshiva because of this fact, because it was taking too long. I was deeply hurt. And so I went to Rav Lichtenstein, hoping for some consolation. I think I was hoping for more than some consolation. I was not only hurt, I was upset. Even though it wasn't really my place to be upset, it's perfectly understandable. But knowing Rav Lichtenstein, knowing they had no patience for people who wanted to make it for breakfast, I thought he was going to launch into a sicha. He was going to clap on the bima and say, "I've heard people aren't coming to Minyan because of this. It's not right. That's what I was hoping for." But thank God, he didn't do so. Lichtenstein was more, had the wisdom and the sensitivity to talk me down, to make it clear that there was something understandable about the complaint, even though he understood how hurt I was. And that was the end of the conversation. To tell you the truth, I didn't feel all that consoled. I did feel calmed down. I wasn't so consoled. But several days later, it was Motzei Shabbos, there was a petek on the thermostat saying there's going to be a shiur on Tefillah B'Tzibur. And he gave a shiur, an hour and a half shiur, on Lamdus, Tefillah B'Tzibur. And he mentioned in passing how important it is, even if it may be a little longer than the other option that you could have. He didn't mention that there was anything that prompted this. He certainly didn't mention me. That made me feel like $1 million. He had thought about how hurt I was. He had thought about what is the best way to deal with the situation, and he had devoted an entire shiur, an hour and a half, to dealing with the subject because it hurt me. He didn't launch into a sicha. He didn't embarrass anyone. The sensitivity that took is something that I will always appreciate. His unassuming manner and his humility are, of course, also legendary. I just want to say a few things that struck me. He gave us an exam in a few zmanim. A few times we're at the end of the zman. He gave us a written exam in class, so to speak. He came and he proctored the exam. He sat there from beginning to end, not doing anything else. He wasn't learning, he wasn't doing anything. He sat there and watched us proctoring an exam. And then he marked the exams. He had so much more to do with his time than to proctor an exam. He could have asked anyone to proctor the exam, to sit there and proctor the exam. But he was teaching us that nothing, this wasn't beneath him. If he was the Rebbe, why wouldn't he be the one giving the exam? If he was the Rebbe, why wouldn't he be the one giving us feedback on the exam? He took meticulous notes during Chaburas. More than anything I got out of Chaburas, I apologize, I've gone way over. More than anything I got in the Chaburas, in the Kolel, was that whenever any one of us would give a Chabura, he would sit there and take notes on every single thing we said. Not only on the things that he wanted to criticize. He wasn't just taking notes so he'd have something to say at the end. He took notes as though he had something to learn from us, as though our chabura was something that he could actually learn from. And he was so sincere. He didn't just look sincere. He was a paradigm of sincerity that we actually were under the illusion, or at least I was, for a few hours of my life, that that was true. My name being Aaron, I was witness to some pretty awkward moments. Things, I had heard about these things, but I would not have believed them if they hadn't happened to me. I tell you, it happened several times. Someone would shout out to me or call out to me, Aaron. If Rav Lichtenstein was standing within earshot, if his back was turned, he would turn around and say, kid? As far as he was concerned, he was just Aaron. I mean, then I looked and saw that the face on the other person was just... he didn't know what to do. I mean, you don't feel like you should have to say, no, Rebbe, I wasn't referring to you. So you just kind of awkwardly gesticulate to indicate that this moment just has to end. So he had remarkable sensitivity, remarkable humility. But that a single individual managed to have all of these seemingly conflicting characteristics, a towering intellect, that he was measured and complex, that he was an intense fire, that he was deeply sensitive and completely unassuming, that he was so demanding but so understanding, was quite literally incredible. Like Rabbi Karmi said in his Levaya, people overuse, misuse the word incredible. I mean it here quite literally. It could not have been believed. I would not have believed it possible. I understand why my high school Rebbe couldn't have believed it possible for there to be someone who was like this, to have all of these different characteristics. It wasn't just their number. It was the fact that they were seemingly irreconcilable, seemingly in tension. And yet, to use the term that Lichtenstein applied to his Rebbe, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, he was a remarkable fusion. A remarkable fusion of all of these characteristics. I'm so privileged, so grateful, so lucky to have sat and learned in his presence to see what an Adam Gadol can be. He set a standard that I would have thought humanly impossible, perhaps just impossible, period, to meet, and which is still clearly beyond my grasp. But I take solace in the fact that he would have understood, he would have been understanding of my inadequacies. For those who said Hallel this morning, he said, Ana Hashem, Ki ani abdecha, ani abdecha ben amasecha, Pitafto Moshe Rai. I am an Eved Hashem, in large part, because I'm the child, biological and spiritual, of Avdei Hashem, deep Avdei Hashem. And for that, I'm very grateful. Yehi Zichro Baruch.